WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In cities and towns around the country, today is being celebrated as a new day beyond ERA, a day symbolizing renewed commitment to the Equal Rights Amendment. In Philadelphia, the Mayor's Commission for Women sponsored a new day for ERA luncheon, and this rededication to equality coincided with another celebration, the 10th anniversary of Ms. Magazine. And two of the co-founders of Ms., Gloria Steinem and Pat Carbine, were guest speakers at this luncheon this afternoon, and they're both with me now on Fresh Air. By the way, I also attended this luncheon, which is why I wasn't here for the first half of this afternoon's program. My guest, Gloria Steinem, is a founding editor of Ms. Magazine, Pat Carbine, a founding publisher, and I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air and also wish you both a happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Let's start with the ERA, and then we'll talk a little bit about the history of Ms. and your involvement with the women's movement. I'm sure for the past several weeks or months, you've been sitting down and asking yourself, what does it all mean? What does it mean, the fact that the ERA didn't pass this time around? When you ask yourself that, what are some of the answers you come up with, Gloria Steinem?
Well, the main answer is the state legislatures, because they have been operating in comparative obscurity when you compare them to Washington, for instance, and they have been, even compared to Washington, more likely to be the bastions of special interests. I think that what I'm concerned with most right now is that though we pro-equality groups, whoever we may be, need to examine our tactics and look at our mistakes, that we not allow the country as a whole to blame the victim. That is to say that it was somehow the fault of women, or for that matter of pro-equality men, that the Equal Rights Amendment didn't pass, but instead to see the fault and the lack of representation in state legislatures, because we, you know, if we allow the press and the country at large to blame the victim, we're not ever going to learn from the lesson and focus on those state legislatures that are in fact going to be dominating our lives even more than they did with the Equal Rights Amendment because of the new federalism, because of block grants being distributed there and kinds of questions decided that would pre-Reagan have been decided in Washington. It's that, my worst fear. I mean, it's bad enough to have lost. I think that defeat is, women have had enough defeat. We know how to lose. Thank you very much. We could win once in a while. We have won many things in this process, but it's a major, major concern now, I think, that we put the blame where it belongs.
What are some of the things you think about Pat Carbine when you ask yourself what it all means?
Well, I think in part about the media coverage, or lack of it, of the ERA. In many ways, if you go back through the traditional media and look at reportage over the past years, it suggests that there has been an equal division in the country about this subject, that there was almost a 50-50 split, which, as we know, has not been true for, well, I guess maybe 5-6 years. There has been majority support among both men and women for the Equal Rights Amendment. But what is fascinating to me is to, as I have been traveling around, is to ask a group of people, for instance, in communities around this country, and very diverse groups to whom I've been speaking, to name a person other than Phyllis Schlafly who is opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment. And what is fascinating is that nobody can name another name. Now, what's, I think, very significant about this is that the media has taken Phyllis Schlafly and used her as a way of suggesting that there is equal opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment, which we know is not true. So, and I think Gloria made a very good point today at the lunch that you referred to. And I wish you'd really repeat that, Gloria, because you were talking about the lack of coverage.
Well, I think that from the point of view of journalism, there really ought to be considerable shame that this major issue has never been the subject of an independent investigation, what it really will and will not do. The Fairness Doctrine has begun to serve, especially with the Equal Rights Amendment, as an excuse for a lack of digging and a lack of good reporting. We've had this problem in the past. For instance, in the early days of the Civil Rights Movement, reporters would dutifully report that 10 SNCC workers had been beaten up by the sheriff, and then they would also report that the sheriff said actually they got drunk and beat each other up, and you never knew what was true. That was equal time, 50-50. At a certain point, though, reporters began to take the responsibility of investigating and finding out to the best of their ability what was true. That has never once been done for the Equal Rights Amendment by any major newspaper, radio station, television network, no one. At news magazine, absolutely no one. They have just been content to show one person saying the sky is blue and the other saying it's green. And Pat is exactly right when she says, you know, that Phyllis Schlafly is a kind of artificial creation of the Fairness Doctrine, because she simply is the only person they know who's against it, so she's gotten a lot of exposure. People will call me up, news people call me up and say, come and discuss the ERA and bring an anti with you. They don't know an anti. And I think that it is a kind of miracle of effort on the part of women's groups and other pro-equality groups that a majority of the country supports it. Most are reporting on it didn't even report what it said, much less try to dig into what its implications really would be, which is relatively easy to do. There's 50 years of legislative history. There are states like this one that have a statewide equal rights amendment and are trying to implement it. It wouldn't be hard to report.
Well, you're a very popular guest speaker and also appear on many talk shows around the country, and I'm sure you've been in the position of debating Phyllis Schlafly or other women. How do you handle it when you're asked to debate and you're up against someone who you think is either lying or not using logic in their analysis of the Equal Rights Amendment?
I have always refused to debate Phyllis Schlafly. I never have, precisely because I disagree with this, equal time argument. I've been in situations in which I've been on a show, say a Phil Donahue show, and then he has chosen to put Schlafly on a different show. But I have, to the degree that I could control it, I never appeared in a debate because I think, first of all, it gives people the vision of two women fighting. Secondly, it gives you the idea there's a 50-50 division when there's not. Thirdly, it's a very masculine form. It's like a prize fight. Lots of heat and no light. Tells you who's the better debater, but not necessarily what the merits of the question really are. So I've tried to point out the lies in other arenas. I have a lot of respect for women who do debate Phyllis, though, and in a way, I suppose there was an implicit tactical decision for people who were as well known or better known than Schlafly not to debate her because you increase her audience, and only people who were less well known to do it.
Well, let me just ask you what you think the press should do in covering the anti-ERA movement. How do you think it should be covered?
Well, I think it's I think we still do not know, and if we do our work the way we intend to at MIS, I think we'll shed some real light on the question of what the really explicit opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment has been and in what constituencies it really does lie. I don't think any very explicit work has been done, for instance, on the Mormon Church and the extent to which in so many states it has financially underwritten opposition. And I mean, just looking at this, for instance, the state of Nevada, it's possible to recall that there were, what, Gloria, 11 legislature members of 11 candidates who were running for the state legislature who, as they were making their way around as candidates, agreed that they were indeed, if elected, going to support the Equal Rights Amendment in their state. And once elected, mind you, with the support and some of the money provided by activists who were pro-ERA, they then were forced to change their vote or indeed chose to change their vote. Well, we've never really examined the kinds of forces, religious organizations being one, I think a number of corporate interests being another, who really never wanted, for economic reasons, among others, the ERA to pass because it was going to, in fact, cost money. I don't think the media has ever really looked at that question.
Yet there are only about a dozen legislators who stopped it. It would have been a very good story for the media to do, and indeed, the New York Times was requested to do so by its own reporters. Eileen Shanahan, when she was a reporter there, said, look, this would be a very good story. Let's look at the financial backing behind the legislators who are stopping it, and it's never been done.
Well, you have both worked on, written about, or watched various actions in support of the ERA. I think it was Ms., wasn't it, that organized the women's groups going around in Utah, door-to-door?
No, that was the National Organization
for
Women.
That was now,
right?
Yes, mm-hmm, it was now, okay. Looking back, though, what are tactics do you think were the most effective and which were not effective and ultimately a waste of time and shouldn't be tried again? In the next round, which do you think should be focused on?
Hard to answer that because we want to keep a full range of tactics at our disposal and situations vary a great deal. In general, I think, however, what we have learned is that simply earning the majority support of the country and of a legislator's constituents and saying to him, demonstrating to him that we have the majority of his constituents is not nearly enough because, first of all, his money comes from very narrow groups who are opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment, and secondly, he doesn't believe that people are going to turn out to vote on that issue. Therefore, I think we need to really target. And this has been done to some extent, but it's just that, that we've targeted and defeated maybe 10 to 20% of many state legislatures, but it's not enough to change the leadership. So we have to keep doing that. And now in the National the National Women's Political Caucus has targeted both Republicans and Democrats who were anti-equality. And we have to learn how to turn out our own vote. I think we've too often depended on the press to inform our vote and political parties to turn it out. We, as a women's movement, with all of the grassroots organizing that we have, I mean, in almost every community we have a women's center, a rape crisis hotline, a battered women's shelter, many, many institutions. Most of those institutions have not seen themselves as electoral. So in addition, not to replace what they're doing, but in addition to what they're doing, so that when you enter a woman's center and you're asked for your name and address on a card, there's no place to put your congressional district, your state legislative district, so that we can begin to pull out our own vote. We've learned our lesson, and we're going to do that in the future.
So you see more activity in the future in electoral politics?
Well, not necessarily more activity, but in terms of quantity, but in terms of breadth. So it's not just one part of the movement that's doing it. We all, you know, the electoral system is just one way we're effective. I mean, the women's movement didn't start in state legislatures. It's not going to be decided there. But that's another tool, and there's a large part of the movement that hasn't necessarily used it yet.
Well, the ERA didn't make it this time around. The next time around is probably right around the corner. How important do you think the Equal Rights Amendment is, given that the women's movement as a whole has a finite amount of time and energy and working hours to spend organizing, and given the range of issues that are important to women, how important is the ERA and organizing around it?
Well, it seems to me that when you look at the whole range of women's issues, you're really talking about the whole area of discrimination, from the world of, if you will, education, as we heard today at lunch, to access to the economy in something close to an equal way, to protection of homemakers' rights across the board, having to do with pensions and Social Security and access to credit, et cetera, et cetera. In the absence of the ERA, what I think we're going to have to do, of course, is use the courts in a way that will have to prove to be effective and efficient. We're going to have to monitor legislation and the efforts to repeal or rescind legislation as it exists. I think that while all of these efforts and all of these issues are going to have to be attended to, and I think women have absolutely got the will and the energy and the adrenaline to attend to them, you come back to a reality, which is that the Equal Rights Amendment, as part of the constitutional fabric, would make much more simple the ability to put an end to discriminatory practices and do it with in such a way that we would not have to constantly be on guard of the turning back or the repealing of legislation protecting our rights. So I think you come back to square one and understand one more time that in the absence of the Equal Rights Amendment, we are generation after generation after generation going to be close to the same situation of guarding every gate.
Do you want to add anything to that, Clara Steiner?
Well, I would just like to say that it's not divisible. That is, we need to have democratic representative state legislatures for a wide variety of reasons. Only one of them is to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Another one is to stop the Human Life Amendment, should it come, as it might come, out of the House and the Senate. We need 13 state legislatures to stop it. Another one is to get money for child care. Another one is to get displaced homemaker centers or money for child care. I mean, so it is in whatever – I think we should not dictate each other's issues because we're going to be most effective working on what's closest to us and what hurts the most. But we should cooperate with each other in electing responsive legislators because all of our issues are – almost all of our issues are going to be affected there.
So do you see the ERA drive starting up again very soon?
Yes, but in a much more long-term way, not with the kind of intensity that we have just seen. It will be probably reintroduced this month by Pat Schroeder, the congresswoman from Colorado, and I think it has something between 50 and 60 sponsors already. The idea is not that it can get out with a two-thirds vote of the Congress very soon, given this administration and especially the Senate, but to get legislators to have to vote on it so that in 1982 they can be held accountable at the polls for that vote. Then the long-term planning of trying to open up the most conservative of the state legislatures will go forward. I think what this coalition of issues means, though, is that except in rare circumstances where the alternative is even worse, we shouldn't support a legislator who is pro-Equal Rights Amendment but also pro-Human Life Amendment, that is, against reproductive freedom. We have to act in a plausible way. There might be some circumstances. I mean, if you've got an opposition candidate who's bad on them both, you know, you might end up supporting somebody who's good on only one issue, but only then.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Gloria Steinem and Pat Carbine, the founding editor and founding publisher of Ms. Magazine, and Ms. is now celebrating its 10th anniversary. Let's talk a little bit about the magazine. Would you compare for us the issues you're covering now with the issues covered 10 years ago? Is there much of a change?
I think so. I think that 10 years ago we devoted a lot of space and a lot of energy reporting on the fact of discrimination. Mind you, 10 years ago, very many people in this country thought women had no problem. I think that if we go back to those early issues of Ms., what you'll find is reporting across a whole range of occupations and professional categories, documenting, providing a database that really was, I think, essential to being able to move forward. So early on, I think it's fair to say we spent a lot of time describing the problem and providing the data that quantified the problem. And it seems to me that a lot of things that we are writing about now were impossible to write about 10 years ago. Among them, the marvelous work and creative work of women in the arts. I mean, women really were underground in so many of the creative areas 10 years ago that I can remember one of the most popular pieces we did was a piece raising the question of where were the strong women actresses in films. I mean, there was nothing to point to. Now we can look at a number of actresses like Jane Fonda, like Lee Grant, like Loretta Swit, who are really carving out for themselves, Mary Tyler Moore, carving out for themselves some roles that weren't even thought of 10 years ago. What we now, I think, need to look at are various solutions to the solving of these problems of discrimination across the board. So I think there has been a real progression in Ms. And it's kind of interesting, Terry, because a lot of people say to me, and I'm sure to Gloria, the magazine doesn't seem to be nearly so radical as it was 10 years ago. And, of course, the issues I think that we're able to bring forward are still very, very, very far forward issues. It is, except that popular consciousness is now really, in many ways, caught up with them. But it remains, I think, important to point out that Ms. uniquely has been the magazine to take on the hard issues. It was Ms. who put a battered woman on the cover. It was Ms. who talked about sexual harassment on the job. It's Ms. who really did, I think, the most work in terms of trying to get society to look at rape as a crime of violence. As opposed to a sexual crime. And I think that a lot of the work that Gloria has done in the area of pornography is going to be, I think it is already kind of in the classic mold, and I think there's more to be done in this area. But Ms. has been the magazine to name issues, to learn from our readers what's very much on their minds and what's really going on in their real lives. It's been the magazine that's wanted to tell the truth about women's lives. We're not going to change so far as that's concerned.
Well, Pat, you said that people come up to you and say that Ms. Magazine isn't as radical as it used to be. As the women's movement spreads out and reaches more women and men, is the commitment of Ms. to become more mainstream and reach these other people, or to become more radical and take the women's movement constantly to another step, a step that a lot of people might not be ready for yet, but might, say, in 10 years, be ready for? I'm sure that there's a constant questioning about that within the magazine.
Well, yes and no. I mean, in my heart, I think that radical is mainstream, because I think that, you know, radical means going to the heart of the issue. And if you state the real issue, you will make a broader coalition. For instance, if we had just talked about abortion and not about forced sterilization, or if we had just taken the old language, say, of population control and accepted that as a phrase, we would have remained a divided movement, because that phrase meant racism and control of more of one race or class than another to many people, and it was. However, you go to the root of the problem, that is, if you're truly radical and you say, look, it's not just population control in the usual sense. The problem is that women are the most basic means of production, the means of reproduction, and patriarchies try to control that means of production. So let's talk about reproductive freedom as a basic human right. And that includes abortion and forced sterilization and safe childbirth and, you know, really the freedom and safety to have or not have children. Then you've done the more radical thing, and it seems to me you've also done the more populist thing.
One of, I think, the classic splits within the women's movement and within large groups, I think even now, is, for instance, should the movement embrace gay rights, or should it shy away from that, fearing that a lot of women who might be ready to accept the Equal Rights Amendment will get terrified at the thought of lesbianism and will remain outside the movement instead of coming into it, although they otherwise might be ready to embrace some of the other issues. In other words, staying away from certain issues in the fear that they'll alienate women.
But then you can't do that either. I mean, because our job as writers, the best sort of revolutionary function of a writer is to make coalition language that allows people to come together instead of remaining split up. And if you explain clearly that the Equal Rights Amendment has nothing to do with questions of sexual expression and freedom from discrimination because you're a lesbian or homosexual, and that's precisely why we need other kinds of protections. And moreover, that anybody can be called a lesbian. And indeed, women who stand up for their rights are called lesbians. So it's in all of our interests, not only those women who are lesbians, it's in all of our interests to take the sting out of that word, to make sure that it can't deprive you of your job, your apartment, your children. Then we build a coalition that is in everybody's interest. It would be short-term and, I think, self-destructive and divisive to jettison what is supposed to be an unpopular issue, because you leave it as a strong epithet with which women can be stopped. And you also divide up women. You've lost a big portion of your strength.
Let me reintroduce you both for our listeners just joining us. It's the 10th anniversary of Ms. Magazine, and here celebrating in Philadelphia today this anniversary is Gloria Steinem, who is just speaking, who's a founding editor of the magazine, and Pat Carbine, who's a founding publisher of the magazine. Gloria, you have in a recent, I forget if it's the new one or the one before that issue of Ms., four ways of opposing feminism. And I'd like to go over these point by point and ask you to elaborate on them. And you say that the first is to declare that the women's movement has lost and is over.
We tried to address that in this anniversary issue by using our no comment page, which we reserve for crazy ads and sexist statements and so on, to statements to reproducing headlines over the last 10-year period, each one of which has declared with great confidence and flourish that the women's movement is dead. I mean, the women's movement has been declared dead every Wednesday at tea time since I can remember. It's a way of dealing with social change. There are two ways of dealing with a deep challenge. One is to say that it is failed and therefore it's over, and the other is to say it succeeded and therefore it's over. And both things are used on the women's movement all the time. It's also true that a more sophisticated kind of opposition now is to treat women as a single issue. That's way number three to deal with the women's movement, I think, as if half the human race could be a single issue. Or reproductive freedom, which is a basic right like freedom of speech, that's a single issue, they say, but NATO, that's really the whole world. Well, it's just wrong, and we have to learn how to contend with it. And then, of course, there's just outright opposition, hatred, woman hatred, Jerry Falwell City kind of, our ayatollahs saying, look, women are meant to be in their place in the home, and that's it.
In one of the ones you mentioned is that declaring the women's movement has won and is therefore no longer necessary. I think I've been noticing, and I'd like to see if you've noticed anything like this, that some people are saying, well, look, now that women are liberated and men are more sensitive, we can be chivalrous again. And now that we're all liberated and men are sensitive, men can open doors for women again and light their cigarettes and pick up their check at lunch. And women can wear lace again now that women are free. Have you seen that? And if so, what does that mean?
Well, I think it's sort of maybe a more subtle way of trying to turn the clock back or the hourglass back or the calendar back, for that matter. And we've all confronted that. It just raises and allows you to raise an interesting question about chivalry, which I have always thought of as mutual courtesy. And I don't know any moment when I in my professional life or social life or any life have not wanted to help a person who needed help, including opening doors or paying taxi fares or whatever. As a journalist, I used to travel as a writer with photographers. And photographers, as we all know, carry a lot of equipment. And for the most part, they were always male, since there were no females on the staff of the magazine that I then worked for. There was not a day when I was not holding doors and handling money for my male colleague, because it was the mutually courteous and easy thing to do. Whenever I see an effort to tilt chivalry and give men the right to be chivalrous and deny women that right as well, I like to get to the heart of that matter. I also think that the Reagan administration, more than any other single force supported and abetted by the far right, has tended to give permission to society in general to revert to old ways of doing things, which means the male superior, women inferior mode. And I think it's very important to recognize that and to be very much on guard against it.
You always know there's a penalty, too, somehow. I mean, if it's going to cost me $5,000 a year in salary to have the door open for me, I'd just soon open the door for myself. And also, as a 50s person, I well remember all the times I sat in a car waiting, bored, but feeling foolish for some man to walk around the car and open. I mean, it's dumb. I mean, we ought to have manners that make sense.
Yeah.
Do you find people becoming preoccupied with that again?
No, you don't. I don't think that you get the questions about should I light a cigarette or open a door as if they were great civil rights issues anymore.
Yeah,
I think people are more serious than that.
Yeah.
What's the stereotype of feminism now? I think there are always remains, at least to some people, a stereotype of what it means to be a feminist. And a lot of people still believe that you're issued an ID card when you join the movement and you get a serial number and everything. If the stereotype 10 or 15 years ago was the bra burner, what's the stereotype now?
Well, I think the stereotype then was a white, young, radical left, you know, from in the sense of the peace movement, the new left and so on, dungaree-wearing bra burner. I suppose the stereotype now is not so white, I'm happy to say. People seem to recognize that feminists come in all colors and races and shapes.
And genders.
And genders. Yes, I do think there's more of a realization that men can be feminists too, thanks to Alan Alda and others in public life who've made that clear. Perhaps now the stereotype is a hardworking career woman with a briefcase who dresses for success and wears suits like men. But it's still that she's not a whole person. That's really the key to it. And it's still, in its negative forms anyway, viewed as man-hating or being either hating men or imitating men, one or the other.
You have any stereotypes to add to that, Pat Carver?
No, not in terms of what the new feminist stereotype is so much, but I do see emerging in the realm of stereotypes, one that is troublesome, and it's the we see it reinforced. I think wildly reinforced in advertising images, and we certainly see it reinforced in other magazines for women, and that is the superwoman stereotype. We're now seeing a kind of a reverse of the fact that women couldn't do anything, and now what we are being asked to believe is that women can and must do it all. So that in addition to the three-piece suit and the briefcase, we are expected to be the primary parent of two perfect children and a gourmet cook and have a job that is socially meaningful and how does Ellen Goodman put it? She does a marvelous job of describing the new ideal American woman who at the end of a long and very involved day comes home and does her gourmet meal, has dinner that includes the children in a discussion of the checks and balances of the U.S. governmental system, gets them off to bed, cleans up the kitchen, has another meaningful hour with her husband, and then they both go upstairs where she is multi-orgasmic until midnight. And it's a wonderful kind of an exhausting image of how the ante for women has been raised. I think it's crucial to point out that women cannot and should not be put in the position of being held to that kind of a standard, because if you can't obviously achieve all of that, you are invited to feel guilty. And I think that what we must never do again is allow ourselves to be put back into the guilty mold that we've been fighting so hard to get out of. I also think that in real life, of course, women for the most part do have two jobs. I think that's very important to acknowledge. And one of the things we spend so much time writing about and talking about and reporting on in Ms. are the ways in which that reality might be changed. And that leads us, of course, to the role of men as partners and as parents. And until we really do see men integrated and truly integrated into what had been the traditional roles that women have been filling, we're not going to see women freed from that impulse to try to do it all. I think that's extremely important for the years ahead for all of us, to be very, very attentive to the fact that women are going to wear themselves out trying to meet this new goal that's been set for us, and to resist it with all of our hearts, really.
Yeah, I think the key to all of that is that whatever we do, we're not supposed to change the world around us or make anybody else uncomfortable or change the power structure. So it's just sort of the add-on theory of social change. Well, okay, you can be a lawyer providing you also are a perfect cook, a mother, you know, all these other things. It's simply impossible. I hope in the next 10 years we put an end to certain things, superwoman, that we, you know, we do away with that, as Pat says. We never again use the term working woman as excluding homemakers who work harder than anybody. And we begin to have men who say, how can I combine marriage and a career in a way that's up to now really only women have asked?
As the modern women's movement gets older and feminists get older as well, I think some of the issues that are being confronted are changing. And one of those issues that I think more and more women are facing now is the cover story of one of the recent editions of Ms. And the title is, Are Feminist Mothers More Helpful to Their Daughters Than Their Mothers Were? And it's a really interesting and very funny cover where a mother is walking in with an edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves, which she's just about to present to her 13-year-old daughter, which she looks 13 anyways, and the daughter is sitting on her bed hiding behind her back a copy of the same book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, which she doesn't want her mother to see because she doesn't want her mother to know that she's studying up on sexuality and women's bodies. What are some of the things that you're being told about by women you know who are confronting this kind of issue now, being a feminist mother and having children who you have to educate about sexuality and other issues that are faced in the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's a sort of the add-on. You know, we're supposed to be the same mothers we always were, but now we're also supposed to be absolutely impeccable feminist theoreticians, sex educators, and for our daughters. I think that however, that most of the change has been very good because I see mothers and daughters now becoming friends in a way that they never did before because the daughters realize why the mothers are overly protective or why they have lived what seemed to them to be boring lives, and you know they really are coming together in a much better way, but mothers and fathers and all of us have to learn that you can't give somebody power. They have to take it for themselves. And you can't, you can be there and answer questions and be as honest as you can. But part of what you owe your kids is to be fallible and to admit that you're fallible and to say, I don't know, so that they, and to allow them privacy. I guess the best method, the best guideline that I remember Robin Morgan and I sitting one morning in some delicatessen, she's an editor and a writer at the magazine, talking about a feminist ethic. What would a feminist ethic be, you know? And after about 2 hours of discussion, the best we could come up with was the golden rule. I mean, that, you know, that you, if you put yourself in your daughter's position, and you think, what would I want if I were she? Seriously. Or if men can put themselves into women's position and think how they would feel if they were living the same lives, but they had been born female. Then we'll begin to understand. I really think the golden rule works quite well for everybody except masochists. That's a problem. We haven't figured that out yet.
Another issue that's raised in a recent edition of Ms. is what it's like for women who are coming of age into a world where modern feminism already exists. And one of the women, who's I think like 21, complains that the older women she knows who are feminists don't want the younger women to form their own ideals and values. They want them to reaffirm the values that older feminists have already created or adopted. Do you find that kind of tension happening now?
Well, I was glad to read that piece, and as I always do when I read Ms., I learn something from it. And I get to thinking about the ways in which I think the impulse of older feminists is to want to save some time for our younger colleagues and to want, if we can possibly do it, to try to let our own experience serve them in a way that perhaps is impractical. And I think that in many ways, too, we, at least at Ms., I have to say that one of the things that doesn't exist so far as I'm concerned, is a generational difference. I mean, which is to say that I now realize that I am certainly old enough to be the mother of a number of people who are working there, but I don't see us as being of two generations, and I have really thought of us as being a continuum where the opinions that are expressed, and I think quite openly and forthrightly, sort themselves out according to individual, but not in terms of age breaks. So I in many ways have been, I think, in an environment that has been a little bit special, and I need to listen more to younger feminists, and that's one of the things I've promised myself to do.
What are some of the things you think that they'll say or they are saying?
Well, there's a very good piece in the anniversary issue that encourages me, because it seems to me that these are women who have a new set of energies and for whom obviously issues are going to be different. And I think that time will allow even newer issues to emerge that I don't even see yet. That will be important to them. But I mean, I think part of there's this interesting kind of anxiety. There's an anxiety, I think, among some women who are older, and it's the anxiety that younger women seem to be more conservative than not, and seem to have a kind of notion that everything is accomplished now, that the world is ready for them, and that it's going to be really possible for them to do the thing that we hope and pray will happen one day, and that is for them to exercise choice in a really open marketplace, for instance, if they choose to get themselves a salaried position. And I think there's an anxiety that goes with our understanding, my own understanding, that this is far from true, and a kind of a waiting for the moment of realization that there is a great deal of work still to be done. So that if there is an impulse to want to say, wait a minute, here is how it is, and here is what you must understand, and here are the prevailing facts. What I hope doesn't happen at the same time is that we're suggesting that as they move forward, as you move forward, that it has to be done in exactly the same way. And I can see where there is a confusion there.
Yeah, I think what we ought to learn from feminism is that any relationship, that's a terrible word, I hate relationship, but anyway, any friendship or work, embarked upon by two people, can't be a totally one-way street. The expertise and the control and the learning can't only flow in one direction, because it will be offensive and bad and oppressive if it does. So it's the job of older feminists to understand that we have something to learn from younger feminists, and vice versa. I mean, younger feminists have much higher standards. They will say to me, I mean, women in the office say to me, why do you put up with that? Why do you smile so much on television? Why didn't you, tell them to, go jump off any convenient building? I mean, things that I still am overly grateful for, they have taken for granted and are ready to go on to the next. And I'm really grateful for that. It sort of braces my spine and clears my sinuses. And, on the other hand, I can tell them that that every battle has to be fought 2 or 3 or 5 or 110 times. I mean, I can perhaps keep them from getting burnt out by helping them to plan longer into the future out of experience. But we each have something to bring to it.
Do you feel that the women's movement is being forced to step backwards at all because of the new right bringing up issues that a lot of feminists thought were already won? You said battles have to be fought 100, 150 times. Like, the right to a safe abortion was won, and now it's being challenged again, state by state and nationwide. Do you feel like the movement is getting pushed backwards by that confrontation?
Well, it's getting pushed backward in Washington, that's true. But the movement didn't start in Washington, and it's not going to end there. The important thing to realize about the new right and this authoritarian backlash is that it's inevitable. It is a response to our majority success. 10 years ago, they didn't take us seriously enough to have a backlash. Now, the new right has directed itself almost totally against the women's movement because they, like all real authoritarians, understand that the family is the microcosm of an authoritarian structure, and if it begins to slip away from that too much, then society changes and you lose the hierarchy at the top as well. So, Americans are just learning this. I think Europeans are surprised that we're surprised. I mean, they say, you know, Kinder Kirke Kuchen. I mean, where have you been? You know, where do you think authoritarians start? Of course, they start with the hierarchy of the home and keep women at home, and any rights for women and children are viewed as anti-family. If we recognize it as inevitable, this is maybe a younger feminist, older feminist conversation we're having here, I'm not sure. Because if we see opposition, serious opposition, as a mark of influence, that we are being taken seriously, then we can begin to use it. I'm not saying it's without danger, because nowhere is it written that the majority is going to win. I mean, you know, 2-3% of a country can rule it, as we see almost everywhere, in fact. But that our understanding of the depth of the change we're trying to make is increased by the depth of the opposition. And only after our battles have been won, not only at a legal level, but at a cultural level, so that certain rights are just assumed, will we really make progress. So we have to fight each battle. Progress is perhaps like a spiral instead of a straight line, it turns out. I mean, you repeat similar circumstances. You may feel you are going in a complete circle. But when you look back after 10 or 20 years, you see that the similar repetitions have moved in a direction of a spiral, and history has changed.
If you're just joining us, I'm with Gloria Steinem, who was just speaking, and Pat Carbine. Gloria Steinem is a founding editor, Pat Carbine a founding publisher of Ms. Magazine, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary and has an anniversary issue that is published this month. Well, do you feel that the magazine or yourselves personally have been targeted at all by organizations in the new right?
To some extent we have. I think we are perceived by some fundamentalist religions and local churches, et cetera, as being the messenger that they would cheerfully slay if only they could. We see this, we see evidence of this when in very conservative communities, a school board sits down to decide what can and cannot, for instance, be subscribed to in the school library. And we have, in recent years, been in a number of situations across the country, from Vermont to New Hampshire to California currently, where very, very conservative, ultra-right, fundamentalist, call them what you will, members of school boards have arbitrarily decided that Ms. was not fit reading for high school seniors, et cetera. And we've been in a number of cases which the American Civil Liberties Union really has taken on behalf of students and teachers and parents and members of the community and librarians, and where we've come along as an additional plaintiff, and where up to this point, at least in every case, the right of the school to choose Ms. as a magazine to read has been reinforced. But I think this is going to become more problematic for us. And I think that one of the things that the far right will now concentrate on, and it seems to be borne out by some comments made yesterday, is a wish to excise from school library shelves any publications that seem not to be quote-unquote pro-family. The fact that we talk about families, plural, is already a source of nervousness to members of the far right. And I think in many ways the fact that we talk about choice in all areas of life makes us a kind of target. So yes, we are perceived to be a publication that needs to be watched and monitored. And as I say, I really do believe we are the messenger that they'd like to slay.
Does anything more direct happen? The publication, there's efforts to ban it in some cities, but do you ever get mail campaigns, or do you ever feel like you're being monitored or watched or followed, anything like that?
Well, we get some direct... We get two kinds of things, reports, which we're not quite sure. I mean, somebody will tell us that the magazine is not getting through a particular post office or through a particular part of a post office. When we did a cover story on pornography versus erotica, we were picketed by some members of the pornography establishment in Times Square with big signs that says, "Ms. is bad for our biz," and a few more things I can't repeat that one. When we did a story about solar energy, we were and other kinds of stories we've done too have caused right wing groups to write letters to our advertisers in an attempt to keep them from advertising with us. There's the newsletters that are put out. I mean, the Phyllis Schlafly Eagle Forum newsletter, the Cardinal Mincendi newsletter, all these kinds of things speak of us as godless communists. And what I have only recently discovered is worse than any of that, which is humanists. Humanists, being a humanist, it turns out, is worse than being when I saw pickets outside a speech where I was going and they were saying that I was a humanist, I thought they were my friends, but I discovered that it was the right wing.
You thought maybe they're from the Council for the Humanities and they could give you a grant?
We get reports sometimes that a particular newsstand dealer won't carry us because we're... because he's right wing, because we have a black woman on the cover, because lots of reasons. But I think the most sustained effort against us is, as Pat describes, the effort to get us out of the libraries. We seem to have been selected as the opening gun of the right wing battle on censorship because it is easier to interrupt a subscription than it is to pluck a book off the shelves. Then, having established the precedent of your ability to decide what's in the library, then you move from the subscription to books.
So how are you fighting those efforts?
Well, it is, as Pat said, with lawsuits. But most importantly, the students and the teachers and the people in the community have been fighting it on their behalf and our behalf. That's really what has made the difference, because students have come forward and said, wait a minute, I have a First Amendment right to read here, and been willing to bring cases, as have their parents, as have members of the school board. In California, in the Mount Diablo school district outside San Francisco, the political elections are now, in that area, are now run on who was pro and anti-Ms, because they're trying to get a pro-choice majority on the school board. So we've become that kind of issue, which we're honored to be, because it's something that affects us all. It's very important, I think, in the next decade that we see what the right wing means when they say family. I mean, they do mean an authoritarian structure, and they do think that any guarantee of rights to women or to children is anti-family. When they talk about pornography, they don't mean what it says in the dictionary, where porne means female slaves and it's clearly writing about female slavery. They mean any nudity or sex outside of patriarchal marriage. It's a lot of stuff that we might consider pornographic, like Maribel Morgan, advising women to turn up at the door in saran wrap and black stockings because their husbands are their meal tickets and so on. They teach in church basements because that's okay in the family, that kind of hierarchy and aggression is okay. I mean, the right wing is against the federal funding of battered women's centers, for instance, because that gives rights to women. They call them runaway wives centers. They're against laws against battered children, because that gives rights to children. I mean, once we get that across, and it's beginning to get across, I think the good old American pluralistic "don't tell me what to do" majority begins to take care of itself.
That became clearer and clearer as the Family Protection Act was introduced into the Congress, and gradually found that it, as it was originally written, had really no support at all. But it was important to read what was in that act and to understand what the far right had in mind for all of us.
If I could divide the world unfairly into the three categories on all the issues that you just mentioned, all the family-related issues, if there's the people who would agree with the things you were just saying with that perspective, and the people who are on the new right who believe in the more patriarchal family, and the people who aren't sure what they think about it, haven't really sat down and formulated an opinion. Who would you at MIS be trying to reach? The people who are already basically in agreement with your point of view, the people who could be but don't really have much of an opinion now, haven't thought about it deeply, or the people who are on the right and who are working against the kinds of things that MIS is working for?
Well, I'll give you my answer, and then Gloria, I'm sure, can amplify her own response. But I really do think that our role remains. The role of providing information about women's real lives. And I think that it doesn't really matter where you are in the political spectrum. I think that when you as a woman experience the discrimination and the pain of poverty and the absence of childcare and the lack of understanding of the medical community, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, your politics just don't matter. I mean, your political party affiliation doesn't matter. I think it's important for us to be there for any woman who needs us with information and resources and support and friendship for her at whatever period of life she finds herself. And from the perspective of, do we want to reach out to people who seem to be blocked from the ability to exercise choice? Well, the answer, of course, is yes. But I don't want to put labels on the people that we're trying to appeal to.
Yeah, I think instead of dividing people, I agree with that. And instead of dividing people vertically, we could try figuring out laterally. I mean, vertically, the labels don't make sense. I mean, I always quote Lee Grant, who said once that she had been married to one Marxist and one fascist, and neither one took the garbage out. You know, so I think we're trying to describe real life. As a lateral cut, however, it is true that by the very nature of our form, we are not going to reach everyone. Most Americans don't read. Most Americans watch television and or read very little. We are a mostly text, serious readers magazine. We are already at the high end of the circulation for such magazines. We're 450,000, 500,000. And other magazines like us, Esquire, New Yorker, Harper's, Rolling Stone, whatever they may be that are mostly text, are at about the same place. So in order to put similar information and support into new forms, we need to reach out in television and to do cable shows as we are doing, to do books, to do movies, to do other kinds of things.
So that's part of where the future of MIS is.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, MIS is the flagship and the magazine of record and is used on campuses and so on. And it's also fun. I must say, when we were talking about how things have changed, I think that we feel more free to be funny now because we're not laughed at as much. And there's I noticed that there's much more fun and humor and art and expression and diversity within this magazine, which is a forum.
Well, I want to wish you a happy anniversary. Ms. Magazine is celebrating its 10th anniversary now, and with me has been Gloria Steinem, a founding editor of Ms., and Pat Carbine, a founding publisher of Ms. Magazine. And again, happy anniversary to both of you, and thanks a lot for being with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you, Terry.